This old Indian remembered when there were no white men in the Yukon.
You know, Jackson Foster? Jackson McQuestion, before this country was the Harper, too.
She admired Jack McQuestion and Arthur Harper. They were the early traders who opened up the Yukon Valley to the gold seekers.
Siwash George, you know me?
Something about Siwash George Carmack amused her. Maybe it was because he married an Indian and tried to live like one.
He come here when I was nighttime, and find it gold.
But she had a certain respect for him, for he had picked up the nuggets that started the big stampede to the Klondike. But the gold rush into the north didn't start with the Klondike, and it didn't end there either. It started in 49 at Sutter's Mill. It started in the old gold towns of the West, Pike's Peak, Virginia City, and Cripple Creek. In British Columbia, Indians sold nuggets of gold to Hudson Bay traders. Down on the Barbary Coast, some restless 49ers got wind of it and took off for the north. Then a fellow by the name of Hill made a strike in the Fraser River, and the stampede started. Back east, there was a depression, and men were clubbing each other in the street for a handful of food when they got the word and headed west. They heard about it in Liverpool, Brisbane, and Rio de Janeiro, and men dropped whatever they were doing and set out for a river somewhere north of 49. They poured into the canyons of the Caribou and up the valleys of the Cassiar, and they cut across to the Silver Bow Basin. Through desolate mountains, down violent rivers, and over the glaciers, they crawled, fought, and died, and some of their bones bleached out where they fell. Each man had the same disease that drove him on and tortured, starved, and wasted him, but never let him go. He pushed further and further north and out across the Yukon Valley, and all the while he was setting the stage for the greatest gold rush the world had ever known. Three traders opened up the Yukon Valley for the gold seekers. One was Big Jack McQuestion.
His name is Leroy Napoleon McQuestion. But the story goes, in a rough sea one time, something broke on the mast. He went and climbed it, and they called him Jack the Sailor.
Many a sourdough had Jack McQuestion to thank for his grubstake and his life. He kept men from starvation. He gave them new outfits before they paid for the old ones, and he never pressed them for payment. This generosity was a trademark to the end of his life.
When I was going to school, I'd say, Dad, can I have a new dress for the party? Yes. Can I have any shoes for the party? Yes. Well, can I have a party too? Yes. He was so good to us, and he was so fair and honest.
You could say the same thing about Arthur Harper. The first issue of the Klondike News paid him a tribute.
Mr. Harper's residence at Fort Selkirk had probably more to do with placating the hostile Indians and thus allowing the white man to develop the country than any other factor in the history of the interior.
Captain Al Mayo was the third member of the trio. He was a wiry little man with a big sense of humor. One time, he and his partner sailed up the Yukon with their first steamboat, the New Racket. The Indians at Rampart had gathered on the shore to watch, so Mayo pulled in close to send them a greeting.
They blew the whistle. They took, grabbed their babies and everything and took out to the woods. They wouldn't come out until they coaxed them back to the village.
One of the early pioneers was William Ogilvy. When the sourdoughs talked about him, they almost always said, he loved his job, he loved his country, and he was an honest man.
In 1887, he put the boundary in between Canada and Alaska by lunar observation and was only out a few feet. But I just am so proud to think that it was my grandfather that did it.
He carried his chronometer in his hand across the Dyea Trail. He carried it in his hand to be careful with it.
I just had the funniest feeling of going over the pass and saying to myself, how did they ever come out alive?
When Ogilvie was surveying claims in the Klondike, he had a small fraction left over that didn't belong to anybody. If he had staked it, he would have made a fortune. He said he didn't have the right to take advantage of his job, so he never staked a claim. That fraction was filed on by a Klondike prospector, and it produced $500,000.
I don't think he did anything for money. He did it for the love of the job itself.
Another trailblazer was the Gold Rush governor of Alaska, John Brady. There were thousands of men pouring into the country, and Brady had to meet their problems with practically no laws to back him up. One time he solved a problem personally when a bunch of down-and-outers were dumped on his doorstep.
They spent everything they had at Hope and Sunrise and had no money, and the boat brought them as far as Sitka and kicked them off.
The governor wasted no time.
Dad employed them. He wanted to keep them out of jail, and he couldn't see anybody suffer.
It was August 1896. Siwash George Carmack was fishing for salmon where the Klondike River joins the Yukon. His Indian wife Kate, his daughter Graffy, and three more Indian relatives were with him: Skookum Jim, Dawson Charlie, and Patsy Henderson. Earlier that month, a Canadian prospector by the name of Bob Henderson, who, by the way, was no relation to Patsy the Indian, stopped by Carmack's camp on his way to Gold Bottom Creek. Henderson said something then that may have cost him a fortune. He told Carmack his diggings on Gold Bottom Creek looked pretty good. And when Carmack asked if there was any ground left for staking, he said,
"Sure, there's ground there, but I don't want any of your Siwash friends over there."
This insult may have been the reason Carmack never notified Bob Henderson when he struck it rich on Bonanza Creek. In spite of Henderson's remark, Carmack decided to take a trip over to Gold Bottom and have a look at Henderson's diggings. More than 60 years later, Patsy Henderson told about that trip when the big discovery was made.
Skookum Jim and Dawson Charlie and George Carmack, the three people, they were looking for Bob Henderson. Dawson Charlie is my brother. Skookum Jim is my uncle. But George Carmack, he told me, "You got to stay here. You got to watch your fish trap," he told me. They went up on a Bonanza Creek. No Bonanza Creek yet. It's going to be Bonanza Creek pretty soon.
They finally reached Henderson's camp and looked over the ground. But Carmack decided it wasn't too interesting and headed back to his fish camp.
Next morning, they turned back. Same way. Every place they tried to see gold. But they look a good place. They look a rich place, see? But the halfway they come down, but the quarter mile below an Aledo. They take a rest. They sit down, see? There's no Aledo yet. There's going to be Aledo pretty soon. So the Skookum Jim, he took the gold pond down the creek, you know. Down the creek, he put the shovel upon him. My guy got good gold. Good quartz gold. George, Skookum Jim called, "George, come down here." When George come back, he come. George said, "That's gold. Good quartz gold." They got a shovel and a pick and a gold pond, you know. When he tried the pond, they got a gold. But the gold come from the South Hill. When they tried that, 10 different places, see? When George says, "I guess it's pretty good," he said. Well, they stuck the ground. Fortland they stuck it, see? Fortland won the discovery, see? On a Bonanza. Skookum Jim, number one above, on a Bonanza. And George Carmack, number one below. And Dawson Charlie, number two below. Three people, partners, see? And one clan discovery, see? And Fortland. Next day they come back. And down the camp, you know, down there. When they come back, they got the gold. Well, I see that gold. Just like I don't care. Of course, I don't saw it. I don't saw it, I call it.
Young Patsy didn't know the value of gold. "Just like I don't care," he said. "I know savvy that gold." But George Carmack savvied, and so did the prospectors at 40 Mile when Carmack plunked a shotgun shell full of coarse gold down on the bar. Billy Auckland went to Dawson in 98. And when he was asked if he remembered an Indian boy in the Klondike whose name was Patsy Henderson, he said,
Yes, do I know him. That little whelp. He used to be with Jim a great deal up on the claim. His home was down at Carcross. We call it Caribou Crossing. He was a nephew of Jim's, I think. Yeah.
That little whelp grew up to become the chief of the Tagish Indians. We told Billy, the next time we see Patsy, we'll say hello for you.
If you ever do, just mention my name. But make it Billy Auckland. And you'll see a broad grin on him.
People have given credit to Skookum Jim, Dawson Charlie, and even Kate Carmack for the Klondike discovery. But Billy Auckland, who knew Carmack well, and who was a friend of Skookum Jim, offered a point of view that seemed to make sense.
George Carmack was pretty well acquainted with it all, and he said to Jim, we'd sink a hole here. And why, they fell into a jeweler's shop. It was immensely rich.
There was no doubt in Billy's mind who discovered the Klondike.
Carmack was the discoverer. Jim wouldn't have had the ability to make the discovery, and he didn't have the knowledge of mining to the extent of being able to sink a shaft and make that discovery.
We can draw our own conclusions about who picked up the first nuggets on Bonanza. But the fact remains, the discovery claim was filed by George Washington Carmack. The prospectors couldn't figure Carmack out, for he never seemed to be interested in gold. He was a dreamer, and he liked to write poetry and quote Shakespeare and listen to the music of an organ.
He was fair, blue eyes, always wore a mustache because he said his nose was so large that if he had a mustache trying to hit his nose, you know, he'd kid about it.
He was slow-talking and easygoing, and he seemed to prefer the company of Indians to white men.
Bob Henderson, he was quite angry, too, because my father stuck up for the Indians. That's where he got his name, Siwash George.
When word reached the outside, the stampede started, and the imagination of thousands was fired by the first gold brought out by the lucky miners who had staked early.
I saw Swiftwater Bill from the third floor of the Hotel Seattle throw a handful of nuggets to the people that were on Pioneer Square, and these people scrambling for that gold. Then there I become enthusiastic to come and get some of that wealth.
For a great many men, the Klondike was their last big gamble with life. As they headed north, some went up the Yukon. Some took the old route through the Caribou and the Cassiar. And some took the Skagway and Dyea trails over the passes. But of all the routes to the Klondike, none was more impossible than the Edmonton Trail. 1,500 miles over rocky mountains, wild rivers, and bug-infested swamps. Most of the men who survived it were broken in spirit and pocketbook, and were months too late when they reached the gold fields. Christian Falkenberg suffered frostbite, illness, and starvation. He lost his dogs, his clothing, his supplies, and in the end, his desire for gold. But in spite of it all, he made it to Dawson, which may have been more important than the gold itself.
John and I went the Edmonton Trail. It took 22 months. Rain and snow, spring, winter, summer, for 22 months. We had 8 dogs, Scotch collie dogs. We bought 8 dogs from Abraham Lincoln's eldest son. Robert T. Lincoln, his name was.
Mr. Lincoln's dogs were thoroughbred collies, good for herding sheep and cattle. But they were no match for the Canadian wilderness. They never pulled a pound. The most successful route was hardly a picnic, but it brought the biggest surge of men into the Klondike in 97 and 98 over the Chilkoot Pass from Dyea. Billy Auckland went up the Chilkoot, and his story of the long trek was the story of thousands. But most of them were not as lucky as he was.
I went up in the old steamer Alki from here to Skagway. Well, I landed at Dyea in order to take the Dyea trail up over the hills, over the mountains. So I humped myself up under 100 pounds and I start out. That was the common load for a good husky man. And when I got to the top of the hill, I said, this is too much for Willie. He can make his money easier than this. I could have it packed up for 2 cents a pound, I think. There was Indian packers there, and white men, too, were making a business of packing. That's the only pack I ever packed over the hill.
Most of the men struggled up that 45-degree slope with 1,500 pounds, 100 pounds at a time. But some of them didn't make it. They pulled their hearts out and died on the trail.
It had taken you an hour and a half to get up there with a load. But when you got ready to come down, you'd sit right up at the top of this gully and pull the tail of your parkie up with a piece of stick of some sort under your arm here, like a paddle, and you just turn yourself loose and zip, you come right down there like you were shot out of a gun. And when you hit the bottom, there was so much loose snow had been worn off from the sliding that you plunged like you were going right into a flour barrel. And you had to get out of there pretty quick. Some fellow would have his seat in your backbone, but the next thing you know, he's right after you, coming down one after another.
By spring, there was a mountain of outfits buried in the snow at the top of the pass. And when the big thaw came, there were still hills, lakes, and a river to run before the trail ended.
The whole thing to me is just the old climb, 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 and go down the river expecting to run into sweepers and everything else and upset.
This was the fear of many a man who could handle anything on land, but who was helpless on the water. Many of the helpless ones died at White Horse Rapids, so they bypassed the rapids with a long wood tramway. But before that, experienced boatmen like Billy Auckland led the sourdoughs through the dangerous water.
I volunteered, and I stayed there 3 days and did nothing but just shoot boats down through that confounded canyon and through White Horse and back up again.
Lake LaBarge was the next hurdle, and to the unsuspecting, it looked innocent. But Billy discovered that all still water didn't run deep.
Right at the foot of Lake LaBarge, where it narrows up to go down the river, just before you'd get down, going down the river, you'd see smooth water, but places a little sort of a bubbling coming up. Look out, a rock within a few inches of the surface. But there were so many who did not know that that was a danger signal. Take a chunk right out of the bottom of the boat. Lots of them lost their lives right there.
A man wasn't out of trouble when he left Lake LaBarge, for there was still Five Finger Rapids, where five pillars of rock blocked the river like the teeth of a giant comb. Billy headed his boat for one of the channels and braced himself.
All of a sudden, you know, we took one good plunge, ka-plunk, down there like that, and a big splash came up, and the dogs all jumped right back in on top of us here. Well, that's all there was to it. We was through Five Fingers.
The stern wheelers had a different technique of getting through Five Fingers.
The steamers going up the river, in order to go through Five Fingers, they stayed to the left-hand side going up, and they had the long cable pitched onto something up yonder and came right down here with a float. Well, the fellow would come up with a little stern wheel steamer, you know, and they'd reach down the grab hook and pull up the cable and take a turn or two around the capstan and chugga chugga chugga, away we go. And when he gets up through there, throw the cable off and we're off.
After Five Fingers, it was clear sailing all the way to the gold fields.
I landed in Dawson in the first days of June. You've heard of Skookum Jim, the Indian, and George Carmack? I got acquainted with the Indian and Carmack. About that time, the Indian and Carmack were in trouble with each other.
It was the trouble of two men who had grown apart. Gold somehow had made a difference. Siwash George no longer wanted to live like an Indian, and Skookum Jim no longer needed Carmack, so they parted ways. It was then Billy Auckland, who had become Jim's friend, got the chance to do the job he had come for.
When you can see your way clear, I said, I would like very much to have a lease on a piece of this ground. So they gave me the lease. I got a lease on a piece right at the mouth of Little Skookum Gulch, if you know where that is. Well, anyhow, what money I made mining in there, I made right there.
The western frontier that produced Jesse James and Billy the Kid was also the incubator for the great con man of the North, Jefferson Randolph Soapy Smith, dictator of Skagway.
I knew Soapy Smith in Denver. I saw him in Skagway. He stood on the street.
And he used to wrap a $5 or $10 bill in certain packages of soap. And then he'd mix them all up. And he had a mark, and when he come to that bar of soap, why, one of his stooges would be out in the crowd. He was the guy that bought it.
Even the Yukon Dog Team mail drivers were conned into believing that Soapy Smith controlled the mail.
We didn't know nothing about Soapy Smith them days. We thought he was the marshal. But to get the mail, we had to have permission from him or one of his men.
It was a long rope the frightened citizens of Skagway gave Soapy Smith, and it looked as though it would never hang him until one of his men stole a $2,800 poke from a Klondike miner and forced a showdown with the king of the Gateway town.
He was shot on Moore's Wharf in Skagway by a fellow named Frank Reed.
Smith fortified himself with alcohol and headed for the waterfront where the vigilantes had gathered.
And Soapy Smith had a rifle,
and he shot Reed with the rifle, and Reed pulled his six-shooter out of his pocket, you see, at the same time he shot, and they both were killed, you see.
Just 4 days before he was shot, Smith celebrated Independence Day as Skagway's leading citizen. He sat on the speaker's platform next to the honored guest from Sitka, Alaska's Governor John Brady. It didn't take a Soapy Smith to relieve the miners of their gold. With the help of the saloons, the dance halls, and gambling houses, they became rather adept at it themselves. One time in Skagway, Skookum Jim, Dawson Charlie, and their friends went about it in the style of an ancient potlatch.
They came down there in the fall of 98. They acquired this hotel for a potlatch party. In the morning, there wasn't a dresser nor a bed nor anything else in that house that wasn't just demolished. They just wrecked the whole business. I guess they had to pay for it all, but they had the money to pay for it.
Paying for it didn't always satisfy the law, as Skookum Jim discovered.
And Sergeant Major Snyder said, "Say, Jim, how many times have you been arrested and thrown on the wood pile?" They called it wood pile. Jim says, "Oh, maybe 1,000 times. What for, you ask me? You jealous?"
Most of the miners were not as violent about it as Skookum Jim, but they managed to get rid of the gold as fast as they made it.
There was a girl some time ago when I was panning up there, and she said, "Do you ever make any money here?" I said, "Sure, I made money." She said, "What do you do with it?" I spend it.
One of the most important institutions of the gold rush was the fleet of stern wheel steamers that plied the Yukon.
We enjoyed a fine fleet of steamboats from Whitehorse to Dawson, all commencing in about 1899, 1900, 1901.
The old timers regretted their passing, for they represented one more chance for adventure. The picturesque old boats crawled through hundreds of miles of mountains and plains. They visited trading posts, missions, Indian villages, and woodchopper stations. They would even stop to pick up a single sourdough who needed a ride.
What a wonderful trips. Travel on those boats. We sure miss them.
Some of them were floating palaces, and their grandeur is betrayed even today in the old hulks propped up on the banks of Whitehorse, Carcross, and Dawson City. But there was more than romance connected with the Yukon steamers. For Buzzsaw Jimmy Richards, they were a stepping stone to a new way of life. He had been an engineer and a fireman on 8 boats.
I knew all about running steamboats and firing and engineering on the river, and that meant passing up and down the river. I see what these wood choppers were doing. They were flying all the boats along with wood, and they were getting a big price and making up to $30 or $40 a day cutting wood. Wood chopper would put in maybe only about 3 years here, and he'd have maybe $10,000 or $15,000 and go back home and nothing to it, and live like a prince and get his girl and all that. A poor old miner on the creeks, he'd get some beans and bacon and not much of it, and then just a terrible life. He had a lot of difference.
Jimmy finally graduated to a big buzzsaw, and that's how he got his name. And he found there was also a hell of a lot of difference between sawing wood for the city of Whitehorse and cutting it by hand on the Yukon. Hard on the heels of the steamboats came the White Pass Yukon Railway that refused to die. Bill McBride remembered a humorous incident when he was a boy traveling on the railway to Lake Bennett in 1899. The train was chugging along when just a little way ahead he thought he saw a decorated Christmas tree in the middle of nowhere.
And this tree appeared to be all full of biscuits and pancakes and whatnot. And we found out that it was the tree squirrels around the construction camp had put all this stuff up in the tree to keep it away from the ground squirrels. That's one of the things that would appeal to a small boy.
Bill was working for the Northern Navigation Steamship Company based at St. Michael when the White Pass Railway bought it out and sent him to Whitehorse.
And today I am the last of the Mohicans. I'm the last one of that outfit still working up in the Yukon.
And now Bill, too, is gone from the Yukon. One of the saddest moments for the Klondikers was the death of the overland stages and the big log roadhouses that dotted the route from Whitehorse to Dawson.
And we were 15 days on the road on the stage. At 60 below every morning. You made only one post a day. Couldn't travel any faster than 60 below with horses.
And they had in the neighborhood of 300 horses staked out along the trail at relay posts, a relay post every 20 miles. And they put 4 and 6 horses on these stages carrying the passengers and the mail.
And those 4 horses, beauties, you know, just all right on the bit, ready to go, and away we went. And the screaming of the runners over the rocks, and it was cold.
But you didn't mind it, you were wrapped up, you were comfortably on the stage, you know, and a foot warmer.
They wrapped you in a buffalo robe in those days and put a foot warmer at your feet and hope you kept warm till you got to the next relay station.
Every 25 miles there was a roadhouse where you could rest and get good meals and a comfortable bed. And always clean. And I'm telling you that when you got in there, no matter how the bar was full, of course these boys would always say, hush, there's a lady. They were wonderful places.
Changing horses at some of the relay stations was a contest with time, reminiscent of the Pony Express.
And the minute we drive up there, there is 2 men run out, and one reaches up and grabs the lines from the driver. The other runs around and unhooks the tugs. The other fellow runs and opens these doors up, and the horses go right in there, where it's warm. In a few minutes, out come 4 more that were all harnessed and ready to go. He swings them around, hooks up everything, and away we go again.
Memories of the stage were memories of fun and good conversation, the time to talk and make friendships. They were also the memories of hilarious moments when someone needed a rest stop between roadhouses. Billy Auckland enjoyed the time when a delicate lady informed her husband she could wait no longer.
Driver, stop her. I gotta get out. This Jimmy Williams was a large man, and he had acquired a very beautiful big coonskin coat. His wife was a tidy-looking little body. Jimmy lumbers out over the side of the sled and picks his wife off and sets her down, and he plows through the snow, and she comes along. Jimmy unbuttons his big coat, and he spreads it out and unholds it there in front of him. It is a killer. Well, they couldn't resist taking a peek. Here stood Big Jim with that darn great big overcoat spread out. And a little woman back here someplace, nobody knew where, but they had a good idea.